It's my pleasure to introduce to you Chirag Shah from Rutgers University. Chirag is an associate professor in both the School of Communication and Information as well as Computer Science. And I'm sure, because he's the head of the InfoSeeking Lab, he's going to be talking to us about some of his latest, greatest research results in that area. So take it away.
Thank you. Thanks, Mary, for organizing this talk. And I understand that there is a very important meeting happening soon, so it's okay if you have to leave. I won't be offended, seriously. I'm happy to be here to talk about something that it's kind of a risky thing, right? This is one of those things where you're talking about something that's not based on a lot of empirical work and you know what you're doing. This is based on, wish I could be doing that, right? So I'm taking that chance of talking about something that I've been mulling over. There is some work, but it's pretty spotty, as you will soon see. But this idea of information fostering, where I've been thinking about and talking about this sort of the other side of the information seeking and retrieval coin, right? Where when you're talking about information seeking, normally that starts with somebody having or recognizing some need and actively looking for some information. The other side of this is sort of the dark side, where you don't even know that you have a need, that you're not really looking for something. But someone or a system recognizes that you could be doing something, you could be asking something, and does something about it. Now, this often happens in education environments. If you think about it, normally you don't go to the class and tell the teacher what you want to do. The teacher recognizes what you need to do and creates a curriculum, creates a lesson plan, everything. Right? So there are certainly, you know, many aspects in our life where we encounter where somebody who knows better than us tells us even what questions to ask, not just to give us, you know, answers, but also what questions to ask. So that's sort of the idea of somebody or something being proactive for you. Okay. So just so you know where I'm from, this is where Rutgers is. It's a big university in New Jersey. We recently celebrated our 250th anniversary. When I talk about this in other parts of the world, especially in Europe, they laugh about it. 250 years, nothing. But it's a big deal for us. We're very close to New York and Philly. I won't bore you with all kinds of, you know, things at Rutgers, but I thought I'll just mention a couple of, you know, trivia things. You know, Rutgers.edu is the 8th registered domain name on the internet. I don't know what the first 7 were. The first college football was played at Rutgers. We played against Princeton, and we won. So, well, now we are not so good at football, but, you know, you take pride in whatever, you know, you had. So anyway, so Rutgers University. Now, as Mary said, I direct this lab called InfoSeeking. So we do a lot of work on information seeking, retrieval. And because of my joint appointment in both information science and computer science, I have students who are also interested in these problems, but they come from different backgrounds. They come from different angles. And so often we are addressing the same problem in a kind of a very different, with very different philosophies. You know, some people want to build a system and solve that. Some people want to understand what people are doing and so on. But it's amazing how when you put all those together, what you can achieve. So what I actually want to start with search and talk about how we have thought about it differently. So here's one example with search. Actually, I don't remember if this is from Google or Bing or a composite of those, but it shouldn't be a surprise. So this is the click-through on the top 10 results in a search engine and a result page, right? So not very surprising. The first result gets the most number of clicks, second, third, but say it quickly drops to something, you know, very minuscule by the time you get to the bottom. And certainly, we're not even talking about the second page and the third page where you can imagine it's even less than 1%. Of course, this is not adding up to 100% because you don't always click on things. So why is that the case? I mean, one explanation is we have fantastic systems that get us what we want right there. Okay, and that just that's wonderful, right? And if that's the case, then well, we need to kind of stop doing some of our work on information retrieval. Another reason, and this is where you know we bring in that human element, where we also know from doing a lot of studies that there are many reasons why people don't go beyond this. It's not necessary that they actually found what they're looking for. What happens most times, when people don't find what they're looking for, they're just going to issue a new query rather than trying to find something on the second page and third page. It seems logical. The problem is just because you're issuing a new query and third query and fourth query, that doesn't mean you're going to get a lot more new things. Reason being, that, and this is the human element, you're still the same person. In other words, your way of thinking hasn't really changed all that much. So sure, you can come up with new queries, but turns out that it's you're not going to have very new thinking associated with this. And perhaps you shouldn't think about yourself because you are an outlier. This population here is not what most people out there do. And so this ends up doing being kind of a lot of shallow searches, so you're kind of just skimming the surface. There's a lot of partial information. This has become a big deal in the last few months with the fake news and whatnot. People simply looking at the headline and sharing it without really going into what this article is about. So a lot of misinformation gets propagated, especially sensational headlines. Or you just give up. And people often say this, that if a search engine doesn't find it, it must not exist. Of course, there are ways to address these things, right? And how are these normally done? So you could get some suggestions from the system, right? So because, as I said, you know, your way of thinking is not going to be very different, so maybe the system can help you. Unfortunately, these suggestions are still going to be limited by what you're expressing, right? So if you get related search, well, by nature, it's going to be related to what you provided. So, of course, it will help you expand, but it's not going to really make you jump. Right? So these things are based on your current state of knowledge or past state of knowledge, what you actually already been exhibiting. Right? They're often based on what other people have done in this situation. Right? So that may not be very useful for you, but that's how you know it kind of works. And this is the most important one. People don't know what they don't know. Right, and so this is the situation where, no matter how many queries you do, no matter how much how many ways you ask, you're just not going to get to some areas of this exploration, just because you know you don't have a clear path to that, and even if the system is suggesting how you get to that. So these kind of things got us into different problems that I'm going to kind of discuss as sort of case studies. And all of them are inspired by this idea of, you know, what if we could look in the future, right? Where you're going in this path, or you are at this position at this time, you don't even know where you should go, you could go. What if we could see that, you know, kind of a future? If you take this route, you could end up there. If you had taken this, right? And based on that, say, okay, well, in that case, this is what you should do. And so this whole idea of, and this, you know, to kind of fancy about, you know, presenting this is sort of the idea of Minority Report, right? Where you're able to see the future, and if something bad is going to happen, you're able to stop it. Don't read too much into this. I just like the visual. Okay? So that's where the idea of information fostering. And to talk about it, I'm going to discuss three case studies. And again, this is where I said, you know, this is not a well thought out, you know, thing, but there are these three spotty things, and actually I have a couple more, but we'll probably run out of time, but I'll just mention these three things. Now, for each of these cases, I'm going to talk about the idea and then jump to the results, right? So a lot of hand-waving in terms of the methods, but if you're interested, these are published. Actually, all three of these are part of a different PhD student's dissertation work. And so there are dissertations written based on these things. So you know, I can certainly provide you if you're interested in the details. But for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to talk about the overview, the idea, high level, and some results and what it kind of means. Okay, here's the first case. This is in the setting of individual information seeking. When an individual, and this is the most common, was looking for information. This was a work of one of my students, Chatra. She did her dissertation in 2015, and there are a couple of papers based on this idea. Actually, there's maybe one or two more. Okay, so here's what happens in normal recommendation kind of a thing. So you're going through a search episode, and when there's a problem, and the problem could be of any kind. Problem could be you couldn't think about the keywords, you couldn't find what you're looking for. Number of things, right? And a suggestion comes. So the suggestion could be of different things. It could be keywords, some page to look at. And you, assuming you take that, you have a different kind of now search episode, a revised search episode, because now you disrupted where somebody was actually going to go, and you're taking them in a different direction. So the idea with the information fostering approach is you're going through this search episode. You haven't run into problem yet, but somehow you figured out that down the road there is a problem. There's going to be a problem. And so before you get to that, you intervene at this point and take the person to a new path. So think about this as sort of a traffic problem, that before you get to that accident, you know that there is an accident and there is a congestion on this path. So let's just read out at this point. Don't wait till you actually get to that congestion. Right, and so that's sort of the idea. So that's the general idea. And now I'll give you some results based on some data that we have. So what we did, we actually have this data collected through several different studies. All of these studies are done in lab, where we bring subjects and we give them some kind of a topic. All of these topics are explore research topic, which means there is no one right answer. There's no one answer. But it's about, you know, exploring and collecting. Normally, it's about, you know, collecting as much information as you can and writing some kind of a report. So you're synthesizing it, right? And there's a limited time. There's usually 20 to 30 minutes that we give them, right? So you have to finish it in this. During different semesters, we did different studies. These are the topics. So the task is the same. The task is explore research. But the topic is different. So and all of these things are different topics. This particular one, we actually didn't assign the topic. We gave them a choice. They could pick a topic from one of these five kind of areas, right? And so, you know, I'm just putting the topic headers here, but there was actually a description of, for instance, what we're talking about, global warming. So it's essentially some kind of investigation. Find all the information, different point of view on global warming that you can find and synthesize it. A number of people who participated on these things. So the results I'm going to show you will be based on this many people doing this kind of search session about for like half an hour or so. Now, the idea is we wanted to be able to see, understand somebody's process, to see if this process is good or bad, lack of better words, right? And now, where did this come from? So again, think about it in the education setting. It's not just about the right or wrong answer, but the process that got you to that. So there could be times when you got the answer, but you failed to learn the process. And so that's really not good, because even though you got the answer this time, you may not be able to repeat that. And there are other times, well, you kind of failed, but it got you through this process. That's actually more useful, because now you learn something. So failure could also be a useful thing. And so we said, if we want to look into the future and see if somebody will do good or bad, rather than what they've done so far, let's try to understand the process that they've followed. Yeah. Because think about it, let me give you another example. People have different strategies when they're working on these kind of things, right? So for instance, and we've seen this, some people like to go out and see what's not good first, right? So being able to eliminate what you shouldn't pick. And that makes it easier for them to then pick the right things. So now if I had stopped them at some point in the beginning, say, what have you done? And then I would say, well, you know, you've only looked at all the bad stuff, okay? But what I failed to do in that case, I failed to understand their strategy. So that strategy is such that they're now, you know, in the future are going to actually start doing better, right? You can apply this to, you know, stock market, right? So it's not as simple as just a linear line where, you know, if you've done good or if you're good, the stock prices will be, you know, better tomorrow or good tomorrow. There's a lot more that's going on. So you try to understand the process. To get that process, since this is exploratory search, we looked at different aspects of exploratory search. Okay. So specifically, I'm presenting these three major aspects. There are one or two other aspects that I'm not listing here. The aspect of exploration, how good is your exploration, right? So what kind of things you're finding, what kind of inquiries you're doing, okay? Because that guides your exploration. What you're finding, you know, is that good stuff? Because, you know, we are in the knowledge construction, right? Because you're asked to collect things, synthesize things. So if you're finding things that are, you know, just commonplace, then that's not very useful, but you're finding things that are actually useful, right? And finally, how creative you are in doing this. Again, you know, think about it in an education perspective, creativity matters, okay? And so this is how we operationalize them. So these are the features. The idea is to have implicit features, features that you don't have to ask this people about, but you can just collect by observing their actions, okay? So coverage, you know, information that are covering, number of different queries that they're doing, how different those queries are in terms of their content, what they have discovered, how much of that is useful, right? How much of this is relevant. This, we actually use the notion, this is more of the mainstream IR kind of a notion of useful would be where you're spending some amount of time, so typically 30 seconds or more. Relevant would be you're explicitly saying, yes, I'm keeping this. So in all of these studies, we had people letting them actually bookmark something or save a page. So that's their explicit judgment for it being relevant. Unique coverage is where you being able to find something that nobody else has found. So it's unique to you, right? So that shows your creativity. Likelihood of discovery, you get more credit for finding hard to find things. Okay, so what normally happens in exploratory search, you start by, so think about that global warming example. Most people start by searching for global warming. Okay? And so then what happens, you get a lot of those things that almost everybody finds. You find this Wikipedia article, you find this BBC article, you find, right? So you don't get a lot of credit for that. But if you find something that's hard to find, right, then that again shows your creativity. So you get more kind of credit. Okay, so what we tried two things. One is, in terms of the baseline, imagine you look at how good somebody has done so far. Okay, so you look at their precision recall. Okay, and two, you use these features, which are about the process. Okay, and using both of these sets, try to predict their progress or their position in the future. Okay. So let me try to explain this. So what we're trying to look at is this is the coverage effectiveness. So what they explore, what they cover, how good is this, right? And query effectiveness means how many queries it took them to get to that. Okay. Yes, question.
Were the participants given one of the three options, and this is your objective?
No, so they don't know this, right? So this is what we are measuring. We're just asking them, okay, here's a task, find as much information as you can.
And so their objective is to maximize when they're thinking about making these searches, what are they thinking about?
So we told them that you're being evaluated based on how good that information that you collect and synthesize. Okay. So, I mean, this is vague, of course, and that's part of, you know, the exploratory search, right? Because there is no one right answer, right? But you're given this task to, you know, collect good information based on your understanding. So here's what happens. So this is, on this side is the using precision recall, and this side using those implicit features that I just described. What all these lines show is how much in the future we are looking at. So what we're trying to look at in the future is we're trying to predict somebody's query effectiveness. Okay. How effective they would be in terms of using queries, finding right stuff. And because I'm not going into details, but I can just, you know, mention that what we are trying to really doing is we divided people in four quartiles, right? So the top two and the bottom two. So essentially what we're trying to predict is if I'm observing you right now, 5 minutes from now, would you be in the top or the bottom? Mary?
In the search, because in all the studies you already know the goal, like, is to learn about global warming, but presumably the same query that someone might issue to the goal of learning about global warming might also serve several other goals, and would that affect the quality of your
right research? So we don't know if you're talking about the goal with the query or goal for the overall task. So the goal for the overall task we gave them.
Them in the study, but then I mean in terms of using this prediction in the wild in a real situation.
Oh, I see.
Would it work if you don't know what the goal is?
Probably not. Okay. But I'll tell you about, so we have some other work that Nick Belkin and I are working on, which is to also extract people's intentions. So right now, yeah, what this is missing is, so in this case, we knew what their intention was. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Out in the wild, we don't know why somebody is doing a query. What is their goal? So yes, but we have a separate work in which we are trying to extract that. It's a hard problem, actually. So that's the nice thing about lab study, right? You can control everything. I had a student who was so obsessed about controlling everything in the lab study. He would control the temperature, the humidity, the lighting, the wind, and drove me nuts. Because I had to provide all that stuff for him to, you know, be able to control. let's take the star line, the five steps ahead, which means we're trying to predict something 5 minutes from now. Okay, and so if we observe, let's say this 10 minutes, okay, if you observe somebody for 10 minutes and then you try to predict where they would be 5 minutes from now, this is your accuracy, right? So about 0.45. And here, if you observe 10 minutes, and then you get about 60.6 in kind of accuracy. So these different lines essentially are how much look ahead you want to do in the future. All right, so obviously, the more you observe somebody, the better it gets. Obviously, the closest kind of a pass you have to predict, the better it gets. Right. So the harder problem is to observe a little bit and predict something really far. Right? But overall, these features tend to actually give us a lot better kind of prediction accuracy. In other words, we are able to predict where somebody would end up in a few minutes from now using those implicit features rather than using their precision recall kind of a thing. Now, of course, the question is, what do you do after that? So you figure out that somebody is going to be in, say, bottom half instead of top half or the bottom quartile. So you ask them to change their path. Yeah. So this is where we did some simulations, right? Because if you predict, if you can see with some certainty in the future that this path is leading to something not so good, so you stop the person and say, okay, well, instead of whatever you're going to do, take this different path. So we did some simulations. What we did is, after detecting this, we would try to find somebody else's path that's good. So this is tricky because you are a unique person and what you've done is kind of unique. And so trying to find somebody else who has done very similar to what you have, but in the future they're going to do something better. Okay. But we show using our simulations that actually we're able to find that kind of a path. And if we substitute a person's original path with this new path, this is the amount of help and hurt that could happen. So if we do the switching early on, then this gray bar means there is no difference, right? So that shouldn't be very surprising because you haven't really done enough. We just switch with somebody else's. It's, you know, it's not very, you know, going to differ. But as we go a little bit further, the green bar means you'll be able to get more help than hurt. Because, you know, it's also possible that the new path that we give you could actually end up making things worse. So there's always that possibility. But as you can see that if you add the green and the gray bar, it's always a lot bigger than the red bar, which means you have a more chance of helping and in the worst case, maybe, you know, just keeping the same than to actually, than to actually, you know, hurt them. Okay? So that's what kind of it shows. As you can see that the more further down we go and we switch the path, there's likely to be some change one way or the other, positive or negative. The gray bar diminishes, right? So in the beginning, it's everybody starts out the same in a way, right? But the more things people do, the more variations that happen, and that time you can make more difference in terms of, you know, one way or the other. Yeah.
It kind of depends on how you present it to the user, right? If you were actually going to do this. And if it's different enough from what their mental mindset was going into the task, they might not choose it anyways.
Yes, yeah, so that's, again, the case where, you know, we simulated this. You know, we the simulation was the user always accepts what we give them. In reality, they may not. So one thing we did, which I'm not presenting here, is comparing this approach with what would happen if you just take the related search suggestion from a search engine. Okay, and it turns out that they're actually pretty bad. I don't know how often you've tried. So you do some search and you go to the bottom, whatever, where you get the related keywords, follow one of them, and then you get more related, you know, query, follow that. You do this a few more times. In fact, we found that in just a couple of hops, you are far away from your topic. And so, yes, if you're, but of course, you know, what happens in reality, we're not just blind to just keep hopping like that. You know, you'll quickly realize, well, that doesn't really work for me. Yeah. Okay, so switching to second case study. This was in a collaborative setting, so and as part of Roberto's dissertation, the work that I'm actually going to present here was also was actually done in collaboration with Ryan White here, right? And so it was really nice. I mean, to this day, this is a really nice model of how academic industry collaboration could work. So often we realize that collaboration is a good thing. In many tasks. The problem is it's not always a good idea. I mean, many times collaboration, you know, is costly. It could lead to a lot of problems. It could help, but maybe, you know, it's not worth it. And so the question is, when a person is going through a search episode, how do you recognize that it's a good idea for that person to collaborate with somebody? Right? Because often, these kind of studies either start by assuming that collaboration is a good thing and then studying, you know, how these people can collaborate, right? excuse me. Or they're kind of, you know, doing some other kinds of impositions. And so what we wanted to do is not impose something on people, at the same time, not have people miss out on this opportunity of collaboration. Because if you don't know, you're not looking for it, right? And so here's sort of the idea where we look at two people going through their search episodes, identify somehow that it makes sense for them to collaborate, and then recommend them to collaborate, and then they continue their search episode as a combined collaborative effort. Now, why do we think that this could work, or this is a case? I mean, how often does it happen that what you're looking for is also something that somebody else is looking for, right? So in real world. And so we actually looked into, this is thanks to Ryan, you know, in Bing data, in a given day, people who are doing searches around a topic, right? So we picked this topic. This is, again, in 2010, so this is where the oil spill happened in the Gulf. And so this was kind of a hot topic at that time. A lot of, you know, news stories are coming up. And so this is during 24 hours, this many people working on not just doing single queries, but multiple queries, right? So this is an assumption for, you know, they have a task. We still don't know what their goal is, what why they are, you know, doing. But they're doing multiple related queries on this topic, right? So there are clearly many people at the given time, and even within a given hour, there are people who are kind of working on or at least interested in this topic.
Do you mean that they literally all issued the identical query BP oil spill, or do you mean that there's some set of queries that you've identified as related to BP oil spill and they're each issuing?
Yes, it's the latter. Yes, so they have, yeah. So it's not the exact query. So this is how we designed this in the lab first. So imagine this is where you are. You want to figure out if you should connect user A and B to do the collaboration. Now, you know that they both are working on the same topic. Okay, you still don't know their intention. The topic is easy to detect from a series of queries. The intention or the purpose is not. But let's just go with the what they're trying to do and not why. So you want to figure out if you should connect user A with user B or not. So what you do, you look in the past. You find other people who are like user A. So this user C is like user A. User D is like user B. Okay. And you look at, so you're looking into people who have done same kind of topic or this, and who are similar to A and B. We wouldn't consider this user because this is for topic that's different. Okay. But we're considering all these users that have all worked on topic T1. We find, and this is where we do some simulation, what would happen if this person who's like A and this person who's like B were to put their efforts together? Okay, what would it result? Would it result in something better than what C would have done or D would have done on their own? Okay, this E is like A, so let's also check E and D, right? F is like B, so let's check E and F and so on. So you're trying all these possible combinations of people who are like A and like B, working on the same topic, to figure out if it makes sense for A and B in this time to actually work together. Yeah. And so what you come out with some confidence because you never really know for sure, right? But then you can say, hey, we are 80% confident that if you work with this person, you will achieve something better than you could do on your own. Now, of course, in real life situation, it would be up to the user to take this or not, right? Maybe you still don't, even when I tell you 100%, you still don't want to work with somebody. Well, that's your choice. But at least, you know, what we are doing from our side is being able to predict this, being able to make this recommendation. And the way we are
do you have any sense of how end users would react to it in terms of, you know, of course, like we know as computer scientists or people who work at a search engine company that, you know, these companies are tracking tons of information about you and know so much, but most end users are probably don't know that or are kind of like blissfully unaware of that. But this sort of like suggestion of like, we know you're doing this and we know someone else is doing this and would you like to meet up, like would that kind of break that illusion for the users?
Yes. Yes, so in terms of actual application scenario, I don't see this in the open web, but I see it as the enterprise level where you can, you know, do this and where, you know, yeah, but you're absolutely right. It will be very creepy to actually.
This is more hypothetical, but I could imagine this would lead to interesting new kinds of spam. Because, you know, it's always arranged, like every time the search engines introduce a new feature, like the spammers and the SEO people like come up with a new workaround. And I could totally imagine like a whole new model of spam where people take certain trending topics and begin to search on them in the hope that they'll be matched up with another user and then they can direct
so you can
sell,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I think many reasons for not deploying this on the open web. But I think at the enterprise level, it could be useful. So we're looking at the similar to what we described before, the search effectiveness and efficiency, and this is what we are measuring. Okay, so we did some experiments in the lab first. We had 120 participants in 60 pairs, and they all did about 20 minutes of searching. This allowed us to create, and this is where the simulation starts, right? So we can create possible 7,000 or so pairs to be able to kind of see, test this. When we do that, this is what we find. So this is the effectiveness and efficiency. So there are six lines here, and this is cumulative. Maybe this makes more sense. So there are three sets of lines here. One is looking at an individual, right? What an individual is able to do in terms of effectiveness and efficiency, right? Then looking at the team. So as two people work together as a team, what they're able to kind of do. And these lines are where we are able to say, well, you should work with this person. So what happened in this actual lab setting, people came together in pairs. Okay, and so they worked with whosoever they came with. We didn't actually forcefully assign them. They were able to pick their, right? But maybe who they came with was not the most optimal partner. Okay, so that's the second baseline of the team, right? The first baseline is an individual. When they work in a team, then they're able to do, of course, more than what an individual will do. But if they work with somebody who we suggest they should work with, they could do a lot better.
So I have a question then about the simulation. Are you, presumably, let's say there's like one person out of these 120 who's just the best searcher, right? So their search performance was awesome. In your simulation, could you theoretically be pairing all the other 119 people with the one researcher as their partner?
No, actually, I don't have the number. But yeah, we did look into that because the problem was, the question was, are we overloading some people who are good? You know, they may not be one person, but they could be a small set of people who get overloaded. And this same thing happens in question answering system also, right? Like I am an expert kind of a thing where same person gets contacted all the time because, so I don't have the numbers yet, but we did look into that there was, it wasn't a uniform, but it was also not completely skewed like that. But you can imagine then, you know, having some damping function that allows you to not, you know, have the same person kind of pair more than some number of times. But yeah, we did look into that. Gosh.
How would you say this is different from search engines saying, like, oh, other searchers looked for, and here's a list of query, or here's a list of top results? Like, I mean, like when you're trying to buy something, this always happens, right? And so Is there a difference in, like, when you're saying there's a particular person as opposed to this abstract average of other people?
So if this were actually deployed in real life, then yes, there's going to be a difference because the idea is you're being paired with somebody who's working on the same task. So it's not just running one query or a couple of queries, but, you know, you're working on a task. So you get paired up. So then there could be, you know, some interactions that can allow you to learn from each other. In simulation, what ends up happening is we are simply putting the whole session of one person with the whole session of the other person. Now, the whole session includes not just the keywords or the queries, but also the exploration, the pages that you look at, right? So that's different than simply telling each other, here's a keyword, right? So you're also basically, if you're collaborating with me, you're not only bringing your keywords, but you're also bringing all the things that you've looked at, whether through those keywords or some other way. So I'm benefiting from all of that, as opposed to, hey, you know, you've tried these queries. And once again, we did the help and hurt thing. So if you were to give the suggestion, if the user would take it, right, and in every case we simulated that the user will take it, then what are the chances that it will help them, it will hurt? The sooner they take the suggestion, the more chances of helping. Again, it shouldn't be very surprising because the longer you wait, then there's less that you can do with the collaboration. Okay, then we applied this to the data from Bing and Internet Explorer toolbar. So what we did, we found, actually, and when I say we, it's really Ryan, because we didn't have access to the data directly. Ryan did all these experiments here. On sessions related to oil spill in US Gulf, Using the lab study queries, so Mary, back to that question, you know, so we looked at a set of queries that are about that oil spill, and using that.
Does that set of queries, does that have to be manually curated, or can you kind of infer that automatically?
Well, in this case, we didn't have to do that because we had the set that people actually used from the lab session. So we just took that. But, you know, I don't know, in a different scenario where sort of like a cold start problem, if you're starting with nothing but a topic, then, yeah. So after cleanup, we had about 9,000 sessions. And we did similar experiments with this. In this case, there are only four lines instead of six because we didn't have actual teams. So these are actual individual users, right? So this is what individual users' lines are. And this is what if they take our suggestion to be paired up. And these people, of course, never really talked to each other. They were never really teams. So this is just a simulation based on kind of a thing. All right, so, yeah.
In the simulation when you pair people up. So when you simulate pairing people up, it basically just means, let's say there's the set of queries that I issued and then the set of web pages my queries retrieved and the set of queries Jamie issued and set of pages hers retrieved. When you simulate pairing them up, you're just assuming that those two things are combined, like that if we were really collaborating, we would have still each done the same set of queries and just shared everything we found with each other.
Yes.
And how are we realistic, do you think that would be to what actually human behavior was if they were actually not paired up and started collaborating in real time?
Yeah, so what this gives us is a lower bound, right? So the worst thing you can do in a collaboration is simply do your thing, you do your thing, and you just put it all together.
But the question is, what people really do. Like, I could imagine a scenario where, let's say, me and Jamie start on this path, and then your system introduces us, and like, you're both interested in the Gulf oil spill. And now maybe we have a chat and we're communicating and maybe we influence each other to write, each do have as much work. Or I'm like, let's both search for the query Obama. And then, you know, so you could actually imagine our search space might get smaller somehow.
That's absolutely, that's possible. So what we are trying to show here, so presumably when you have a real collaboration, you can do better than this. You can do better than you just do your work, she does her work, and you never talk to each other and you just put it together. So that's the hope, that in a real collaboration, you will do something better. So this is, in a way, it's a lower bound. So if you do nothing else, if you simply put these together, this is what you can achieve.
Oh, I'm imagining hypothetically, I mean, obviously that would be fan of collaboration. I'm imagining
hypothetically, I assume there's a possibility people could do worse, because like, I influence Jamie to take on a bad strategy.
I'm the better searcher, and rather than me doing
Yeah.
And you create a search bubble stuff. Kind of thing or something. Right?
Absolutely. So that's always possible. So we can't measure it here because that requires doing a lot more than just looking at their search patterns, right? Because I don't know your personality. I don't know, you know, when I start talking to you, what would happen? You'll say, hey, you're doing this anyway. I shouldn't probably do anything. And so a lot of things could happen. That's where the social element is, right? And we often have to recognize that in collaboration that it's never as simple. There's a social element because that's why these are simulations. They're not realistic, but what hopefully they give us that lower bound that hopefully we can do better than simply put our stuff together. Take advantage of the interactions. Right? Okay, so in the interest of time, I'm going to jump to the last case. This is more recent, so we don't have a lot of results. This is a work of Dongo, who hasn't defended his dissertation. Mary is actually on the dissertation committee, so it will also be up to her. But we have some preliminary ideas and results. It's also something that I'm very excited about because it's kind of, you know, different. So we've been looking at this sensors that people use. So again, this comes from collecting implicit signals from people. Right, so the search logs is an example of that, where you're just being able to collect that log data without really asking people about this. So the nice thing about all the sensors, whether it's your smartwatch or health tracker, you know, it provides certain functionalities to the users. It's great for the researchers because it's a new method of having access to data, and it's hard to lie with this, right? Though people have actually managed to lie in terms of their walking and running, you know, with this fitness. You can fool any system, right? But assuming that you're not one of those, you know, this kind of gives us access to a really good kind of a data. It's passive data collection, so you're not disrupting anyone. So that was kind of one of the motivations. On the theoretical side, we looked at this idea of foraging, right? So foraging, it refers to geography movement of animals, right? So you kind of go from patch to patch looking for, you know, grass or meat or whatever, you know, to kind of, or resources in general to exploit, and then you kind of move on. So information foraging is sort of a similar idea, except that it's in the information seeking setting where you're doing the searching or browsing to collect relevant information. And again, you know, you're moving from information patch to information patch. How do you decide? So think about the first example that I gave you where you do a search, you get something. If you're not happy with it, you have a couple of options. You can maybe go to the second page, third page. Maybe there's something there. Or you can issue a new query. In other words, you decide to possibly move to a new patch, right? So we asked this question, does that human foraging behavior connect in some way with the information foraging, right? So the idea of information foraging has actually inspired, has come from that animal foraging. And so now we are asking, you know, well, can we connect these two? Okay. So this is what we did. This is a little older work, but, you know, it was almost preliminary work where we got 35 participants. We had them kind of just be themselves for 2 weeks. So this is a field study. What we did during that time, we gave them a mobile app that will track their location. Okay, so we collected essentially their location data for those 2 weeks. Then we brought them to the lab for about 1 hour lab study. During that lab session, you know, we give them an exploratory search task. Okay. We also had them take a personality questionnaire to trying to understand who they are, right? What we're trying to do is have some measurements for their geographic movement during that 2 weeks. So these are the things that we kind of came up with. How many unique places they visited? How different their kind of distribution was, right? How often they visited the same place again and again, right? So these are sort of attributes of your sort of characteristic of your geographic exploration. And we're trying to find something parallel, though we didn't quite get there, but, you know, similar in a search setting where looking at inter-query diversity, so how different two queries are. Okay, how many different queries you do, how different they are. Within a given query, how much kind of difference you have in terms of information content. And when you go out and explore things, well, what is the novelty? How different kind of things that you're you know, seeing, right? So on one hand, you have the geo-exploration. On the other hand, you have online exploration. And we found some interesting correlations. So one kind of exploration is correlated in one setting, you know, the geolocation, you know, related to information exploration. So that was kind of a first step, right? I mean, it's kind of nice to see that there's correlation. So, of course, the next thing is, can we predict one kind of behavior having learned the other kind of behavior? And so we did this using two different methods. Other than the random, we also used the Big Five personality test. So this is where we had the questionnaire for the personality. And if we know somebody's personality, then trying to predict their search behavior as measured by these three things. And measuring their or predicting their search behavior having learned about their geo-exploration. So location data or the geo-exploration gives us the highest kind of, you know, accuracy among these methods.
I'm sure I understand. When you talk about their search diversity and their geo-exploration, are those things connected? Are they searching from their mobile device while they're walking around?
No. They're not doing searching. They're just living their life, going around. So the location diversity we are measuring in terms of how many different places they visited in the last.
From their mobile device. I'm just wondering.
No. So this is
causation in terms of like presumably people who are out and about more. If they also do mobile searches like many people do nowadays, maybe as opposed to just you know that their personality is more exploratory. It's the fact that they are in many diverse physical environments that then cause new and diverse search needs that they're doing from their mobile device, right?
But that would be a different thing, right? So I agree with you. So we have a. We still haven't done the mobile search. We are still looking at just the mobile locations.
So non-mobile queries. These are
right.
Queries.
Yeah. So these things are in the lab. Okay. So they're doing this, and so we're trying to. So these are in a way completely different things, right? One is where you're just living your life, going to some places, and it turns out that learning about that tells us about what you would do when you're given a search task. But you're right. So if you're really and we have a new study which where we are also looking at not just their exploration, the mobile exploration behavior, but also during that time what kind of searches they are doing. Right. So that's actually ongoing work where we have.
I'm just trying. Can you go back a slide?
Yeah.
What else would correlate with that?
What do you mean?
With the geolocation information. Possible that because they go to more diverse geolocations, they're exposed to more diverse information in general?
Well, I don't know. So what we don't know is what they're doing there.
Yeah.
At least we didn't know in this study. The next study, you know, which is ongoing work, which Dongo is doing, he actually asked people to annotate. So he would show every week, these are the places that on a map. These are the places you visited. What were you doing there? So here, in this data, we didn't know.
Was there any correlation between location? Like between your metrics? Like, I guess there.
Yeah, so the thing is, we didn't find, I don't remember the correlation, but at least we didn't find Big Five to be useful in this case. But, you know, thinking about it, it's not surprising. Because what Big Five does, you know, it gets your sort of a personality in general. But then, you know, given a specific task, it may not come out, at least that way. So in general, you may be, say, introvert, but when you sit down to, like, do search, you have all kinds of wonderful, diverse queries, right? So it's not able to predict.
When this is even before you start the query, like, if Big Five correlates with location, it's like people who are more open.
Oh, I see.
You go to more locations, and then maybe you only have very few participants who are open, but they go to more locations, so you have, like, I don't know.
No, I don't recall the correlation, yeah, but I can certainly look into that, the Big Five and the geo exploration. Yeah. We're looking at connection to the online exploration, and we didn't find, you know, there to be, you know, a good relation.
Are all the participants college students at Rutgers? Because I was wondering if it would be something like,
yeah, so there is a limit
educational or socioeconomic status where presumably people who are wealthier travel around to more places, but then that probably also correlates with being more educated, and so then you have more diverse queries or something like that.
Just how our spatial abilities in general might be correlated with such behavior.
Yeah, so the spatial ability is something that we measure in this ongoing work. And so I'm going to quickly run through this. This is my last kind of thing. So we did the now, you know, 4 weeks. During this 4 weeks, we were tracking their geolocation as well as their searching behavior. Then we brought them to the lab. We had half an hour of treasure hunt. So we set up a treasure hunt game in a building where they had to kind of look for this. During that time, they were wearing this video camera so we could see where they were looking at and everything. We also had half an hour escape room game, so we locked them into a room, and they had to get out using whatever problem solving. And then we had 1 hour lab study. We used spatial ability tests to see, you know, if that has any correlation. By the way, this is ongoing work, so I don't have results. I'll tell you something. We had personality tests, risk and time preference, right? How risk averse you are, maybe that has something to do with location data, browsing and searching data, movement data, so you know, these are kind of things. Some things that we already found, people who are risk averse issue fewer queries. Now, these are like very preliminary things. We haven't really dug deeper into this. Short-term impatient people, they settle for less novel information. And we also did this simulation. If we know people's whatever behavior, can we apply it to collaborative settings? So can we figure out what is who's the optimal person to collaborate with? And this is like really just yesterday. Don't go send me the. So I'm just reporting the bottom line. I have the whole write-up that he did. But working with similar people in terms of exploration, in most of the cases, they exhibit better performance than random matching. Okay, so I want to actually wrap up because we are also out of time, and I know some people need to leave. So, so there are things where we can detect not just the problems but also opportunities. So this work is not just for finding potential problems but also finding potential opportunities. And time is of the essence. If you wait too long, if you wait till that happens, that problem happens or that opportunity comes, maybe it's too late. We believe that the search behavior is not an isolated behavior of human nature. It is linked to some other fundamental behaviors that we have. And part of this inspiration here is also trying to find that fundamental link. What is it that we can learn from other kinds of behavior? Yeah. This is, of course, based on this idea that people are rational in some way, that they're not behaving randomly, that there's something inherently. There's a pattern, right? There's something, that we can capture and predict. It will allow us to go deeper into people's, understanding their people's behavior and using that for personalization and recommendation. And we have access to this new modalities, things that wasn't possible maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or 5 years ago. That could give us deeper insight into people's behavior. Finally, I'm going to skip this thing. I want to bring this up, back to that information seeking and fostering idea. I'm putting this what Brooks calls the fundamental equation of information science, where you are in some knowledge state, and some new information comes that takes you to this new knowledge state. So if you think about, information seeking, you can explain this by saying, you are in this knowledge state and you discover that you have a gap. Something is missing that you need to obtain. And so information seeking is essentially finding this right information that takes you here. Right? This is where, Belkin's model, Durbin's model, they all talk about this gap in knowledge. Information fostering, on the other hand, it starts from this side. It says, well, this is what we want to have you in. This is the goal, right? And so if this is what the goal is, what information can be provided so that your existing knowledge state changes to this? What happens in typical information seeking is you may not realize that you need to go here. Okay? The information fostering, it starts from this side. It says, you need to be here. You need to learn this. So even though you're not asking, we need to be, and if you want to do this, here's the right information. And so this is kind of the way I, connect these. Okay, so I want to end here. Gone exactly 1 hour, actually, if you consider 1:35 start time. And if you have any questions, I'll open it up. By the way, this is one of the agencies that the new administration is trying to cut.
No. Good company.
We'll see. But.
We'll probably a bunch of us need to run.
I gotta run.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much for coming.
Yes.